And joining us on the book club today is Chris Wallace, award-winning journalist and author. He is the author of the book Countdown 1945, the story behind the atomic bomb. We're going to talk a little bit about that in just a minute. Chris is also the author of another book that I pulled off from my shelf, and it is Profiles in Presidential Courage, Character. And he talks a little bit about some of the tough decisions the presidents have made in the past. Perhaps none has been tougher than the one President Truman had to make, deciding the fate of what to do with the bomb. Chris, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Louis.
Let's talk a little bit first about your background. You grew up, and of course, your stepdad was the president of CBS News, your biological father, Mike Wallace. So were you already interested in news since you were a kid and writing?
Yeah, I wasn't sure I was going to go into news. I thought about going into law or politics, government in some form. But in 1964, I was 16 years old, and they had a pure nepotism. CBS, and I think it was a good thing, as a matter of fact, would ask the sons and daughters of correspondents and producers if they wanted to work at the conventions. And I was Walter Cronkite's gopher in the anchor booth at the 1964 Barry Goldwater convention by gopher coffee, gopher pencils. I mean, it was very much an intern's position. But I got to see the news business in, you know, at close up in one of the exciting venues. And I remember thinking, I can't believe they pay people to do this. So I think that's when the news bug really bit.
One of the things that people may not be aware of, when I was researching a little bit about your background, and I found, tell us about your story of what happened when you were in the 1969 student occupation of University Hall.
Well, I went to Harvard. I was a senior that year. And in April of 69, SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, took over the main administration building in Harvard Yard as a protest against the Vietnam War and about the fact that ROTC was on the campus at Harvard. I was a reporter even then. I worked for the college radio station. And we took over the office of the Dean of the Faculty of Arts and Sciences. We didn't occupy the building, but the building had been occupied. So we went there and we turned that into our studio, and we were broadcasting all night. And when the police came in the morning to break the thing up and take the protesters away to jail, we all, with our little press passes from the college radio station, said, "Press, press," they arrested us too. So we got, that's the only time I ever spent any time behind bars with maybe 100 of my classmates. And we were each allowed to make one phone call, and all of us found that very glamorous and exciting. And some people called their roommates, and some people called their girlfriends. And I called the radio station and did a phoner broadcast, and then signed off, "This is Chris Wallace in custody."
I'm sure that that was something that caught your fellow students and perhaps even some of the police and jailers there off guard, because everybody else, as you said, was calling either a lawyer, their college roommate, anybody else, but you called the radio station.
Well, you know, I guess once a newsman, always a newsman. It's definitely in my DNA.
Now, this book, Countdown, tell us a little bit about, first of all, what, you know, with all the stuff that's going on right now, been going on, especially since 2016, as we know, that administration has caused a lot of turmoil on both sides of the aisle. And you know from being a White House correspondent for so many years that it must be very difficult to cover this administration and everything that's going on, and what happened with George Floyd, what's been happening with Corona. And then out of nowhere, it seems like here comes this book called Countdown 1945.
Well, you know, it's not totally unintentional. As I was writing it over the last year and a half, I didn't know all these things that were going to happen now. But one of the things I enjoyed most in researching it and writing it is it had nothing to do with Donald Trump, because you're quite right, Louis, as the host of a Sunday talk show, Fox News Sunday, you know, you cover Trump every week, and it's what he did, what he said, the arguments for it, the arguments against it. And there is not a single mention of Donald Trump in Countdown 1945, and that was kind of a relief. But the best review I got is somebody called it, said, I know what happened in 1945, but this is a thriller. And that's what I wanted to do, is put you in the scene from the moment that Truman becomes president after Franklin Delano Roosevelt dies on April 12th, and then the 116 days after that, they drop the bomb on Hiroshima. So you're along as Truman is consulting with his war cabinet, should he drop the bomb, with the scientists at Los Alamos, who don't know until 3 weeks, 21 days before the bomb is dropped, that it will even work. And then the flight crew of the Enola Gay, the B-29 that dropped the bomb, who don't know if they dropped the bomb because it had never been dropped from a plane, whether or not the shockwaves will knock them out of the sky. So as I say, then most of the people who have read it and reviewed it say, talk about it as a thriller, a page-turner, and that's just what I wanted to do, is I wanted people to have an exciting ride and learn some history, some fascinating history about Truman and the scientists at Los Alamos and the military and some average Americans on the home front.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist Chris Wallace. Chris is the host of Fox News Sunday, and he's also the author of the recent book, Countdown 1945. When you talk about character, you do that exactly, Chris, because I consider it a page-turner, as a thriller, because you open up each chapter with, this is how many days we have. This is what's happening right now. But not only do you just take us into, you know, this is what happened, this is what didn't happen. We go to the Oval Office. We go to the labs. We go to the different bases. We are inside with Colonel Tibbetts and all of that that's going on. So you know from a little bit of a perspective, everybody's frame of reference and what they're going through. Let's start with the way you open up with President Truman gets that call, where he's in Congress, and he's overseeing a debate that is pretty boring, so boring that he decides to pen a letter to his mom and his sister.
Well, he does, and says what a boring debate he's presiding over as the vice president. He'd only been vice president for 82 days, and he'd been very much shunted aside by FDR, the president, who had only met with him privately twice in those 3 months. So the debate ends, the Senate recesses, and he heads over to the House side by himself without any Secret Service protection to what was called the Board of Education. The then Speaker of the House, Sam Rayburn, had his hideaway on the House side where his cronies would come and they would gossip and they'd discuss strategy, and they'd also have a bourbon and branch water. And Truman was a regular there, and when he gets there, Rayburn says, the White House is looking for you. So he calls the White House and says, this is the VP. And Roosevelt's secretary gets on the phone and says, you need to get to the White House as quickly and quietly as possible. And Truman hangs up the phone and says, Jesus Christ and General Jackson, and gets to the White House thinking that he's going to meet Roosevelt. But in fact, when he gets there, Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, tells him that the president is dead and that he now, Harry Truman, is the president. He's sworn in, and after he's sworn in, the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, says, I need to talk to you privately. They go into another room, and Stimson says, I need to tell you about an immense project, top secret, to develop the most powerful weapon in history. And that literally, Louis, was the first time that the vice president, now the president, Truman, had any inkling of the Manhattan Project to develop the nuclear weapon.
Now, Colonel Tibbetts and his crew, they were training, they were doing a lot of flying, but they were not aware either of what was going on. Is that correct?
Well, Tibbetts knew, and another person in the crew knew, but the vast majority of them didn't know. And in fact, they weren't officially informed until the plane was on its way to Hiroshima. And they had armed the plane, and Tibbetts, the Enola Gay, which was named after Tibbetts' mother, and Tibbetts gets on the intercom and says, gentlemen, there are 12 people in the crew, we are about to drop the first atomic bomb in history on Hiroshima. And I think some of them had suspected that's what was going to happen, but some of them gasped and said, now it all makes sense.
They were very nervous when they tested it, and rightly so. In July, of 1945. But after, there were nerves because what if it didn't work? But then what if it did work?
That's exactly right. In fact, almost like March Madness, there were betting pools among the scientists at Alamogordo where they tested it. And some people were betting it was going to be a dud. And others said, well, it's going to ignite the atmosphere. But then the question was, how much damage would it do? Some said it would take out all of New Mexico. Some said it might take out the western United States. This was unleashing the powers of the universe. It had never been done outside a laboratory. And now to do it, to have this massive explosion, nobody really knew, one, whether it would work, and two, if it did work, how powerful it would be.
We've heard from people, and of course you've probably been to El Paso or at least flown here, people who lived here back then said they remember that day when that test was done in Alamogordo, that they felt windows rattling here in El Paso.
Really? I didn't know that. I did know, though, that it was massively powerful and that it did extend great distances, hundreds of miles, and the Army had to have a cover story. They lied and said that a munitions dump had blown up because, of course, they didn't want anybody to know what it really was.
When it was tested, President Truman was away. He was not in the United States, but they gave him word. Take us through that and what happened next.
Well, he was in Potsdam, Germany, a suburb of Berlin, for a summit meeting with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. The Big Three, which had been Roosevelt for the U.S., had a series of meetings during the war. Now the war in Europe had just ended 2 months before in May, and so the new Big Three were going to meet. And late that night of July 16th, Truman was informed of the successful test. And he'd been a little insecure because he was the junior partner in this group, filling the very big shoes of FDR. Now suddenly he's the senior partner because he's got the atom bomb. And he had a number of meetings with Churchill, who had known about it all along. And they decided, yes, they were going to drop it on a Japanese city. It turned out to be Hiroshima. And then Truman had to tell Stalin, who was not aware of this, had not been part of the partnership, and he goes to him in late July at one of these meetings of the Potsdam Conference and tells him, we've got this enormous weapon, and all that Stalin says is, well, I hope you put it to good use against the Japanese. And afterwards, Truman's quite puzzled. Why wasn't Stalin more interested in asking questions? And the answer was, they later found out, it wasn't that he was disinterested, it's that he wasn't surprised because there were Russian spies inside the program, and so Stalin knew all about it.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist Chris Wallace. Chris is the author of the book Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb. When they found out that it works, the president knows, okay, now they say we can use it. At what point does President Truman say, go ahead, use it, and then what city do they choose?
Well, shortly thereafter, after the 20th of July, in that period of time while he's still at Potsdam, he gives the order for it to be used, but he says don't drop it before August 2nd because he wants to be away from Potsdam and from Stalin, particularly when it is dropped. And they went through it. They had about five cities on the short list, and they ended up choosing Hiroshima. I think for several reasons. One, it hadn't been bombed, and they wanted maximum psychological and military effect. They wanted a city that didn't have any other damage so that when people saw what had happened, they know it was from this one bomb. Two, they wanted a target that had some military significance, and there were about 50,000 troops stationed in Hiroshima. And third, the topography. There were hills around the city center, and they believed that topography would accentuate the force of the explosion and make it more damaging. I mean, they wanted to make a statement. The hope was that this would shock the Japanese so much that they would then surrender.
3 days go by, and nothing happened. What happened?
The U.S., they only had two bombs. They used one in Hiroshima. And, you know, people say, well, you know, maybe they would have surrendered anyway. We dropped the bomb, and they still didn't surrender. So on August 9th, they dropped a second bomb on Nagasaki.
As far as people knowing that this had been done after it came out. Of course, they were very happy that the war was finally over. But some of the statistics show that when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, polls showed that 85% of the people in the U.S. approved of Truman's action. What does that look like now?
It's over 50%. It's never gotten below 50%, but there is there's more of a split on it, as there seems to be a split about everything in the country today. Most interestingly, there is a generational split. When you ask people over the age of 65 who either firsthand or, you know, had some recent memory of World War II and the sacrifices and what went on in the Pacific theater, they're overwhelmingly in favor. Younger people who don't have as immediate or close a connection to what happened in World War II, more opposition to it.
As far as when the Japanese did surrender, was there a point where the emperor had to go and convince his generals, his military people, that we need to do this?
Yeah, well, he didn't really convince the generals. He convinced the people. And that's one more statement about it. Even after Nagasaki, the second bomb, the military government of Japan still didn't want to surrender. And so Hirohito, who was a hardliner himself, but realized that there were going to be more bombs. They'd only made two, but they within a few days they would have had a third and fourth, went on the radio. And it was the first time almost any normal Japanese person had heard his voice. And he basically surrendered, went over the heads of the military government directly to the people to say, enough.
One of the concerns the Japanese government had was that if they surrendered, that something would happen to the emperor.
Well, that's right. And the U.S. had always from the beginning said unconditional surrender, and the Japanese worried that meant that he would be deposed and that they would lose all of their culture. And in the end, it was kind of a compromise. Truman decided to take yes for an answer because they didn't specifically call it unconditional surrender. So Truman said, you know what, we'll let the emperor stay as emperor, but we'll say under what conditions. And the answer was, the condition was that he had to report to General Douglas MacArthur, who was the head of the occupation of Japan by the United States.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist Chris Wallace. Chris is the author of the book Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb. As I mentioned earlier, Chris, in the book, you take us through the different characters and kind of get their perspectives, their viewpoints. But you mentioned there are some people who you mentioned in your book who other people might not be familiar with. They've heard of Colonel Tibbetts. They've heard of Robert Oppenheimer. And they've heard of President Truman. But you mentioned some other people like, I just forgot his name, Kaufman.
Oh, Draper Kaufman. Yeah,
yes.
Draper Kaufman was really the inventor of the frogmen. And they said that they were half fish and half nuts. And they started a naval frogman amphibious unit because as they were going over these Japanese islands, they needed, oftentimes the Japanese would have mined the approaches to the beaches. And the concern was that as landing craft got close to the beaches, they just would be blown up. So the frogman, and Draper Kaufman, as I say, was kind of the founder of that operation, would make an amphibious assault before any kind of armed assault, and they would go take out and clear the way so that the troops could come in. One of the things that tickles me about Draper Kaufman is I was sent the book out to a few friends of mine to read first and comment on, and one of them was Admiral William McRaven, who used to be the head of Joint Operations Command. He was the man in charge of the operations to kill bin Laden and to capture Saddam Hussein. And one of the things that he wrote back to me, he loved the book, said it was the best book he'd read this year, which I'm very excited about and flattered. But in addition, he said that he was very excited that Draper Kaufman was in it because he said Draper Kaufman was one of his heroes when he was a Navy SEAL. So, you know, the funny, interesting thing about this book is you're just sort of a generation away from people who were part of it. And in fact, we found two women who were alive during that. One was a 19-year-old woman named Ruth Sisson, who was in Oak Ridge at the nuclear reactor there and didn't know what she was doing. She just knew that she was operating the dials on a complicated machine. It turned out, unbeknownst to her, she was enriching uranium. And then we also found a woman named Hideko Tamura, who was 10 years old and at Ground Zero in Hiroshima when the bomb was dropped and exploded, and a number of members of her family, including her mother, were killed. But this little 10-year-old girl saved herself and now lives in the United States. She's in her mid-80s and has married an American and has lived a good, full life.
What, from the perspective of the little girl, what does she say now? What does she remember? I know in the book you describe her as being at in a school that the girls do not like being there because it's more of a workplace than it is a school. And when she has a chance to leave, she does with her mom.
Yes, well, she doesn't have a chance to leave. What happens was that what they did in a lot of cities is they would send their children off to the countryside because a lot of these cities were being bombed. So her parents, who were quite wealthy, sent her off along with her best friend to a school that ended up being more of a work camp, and she hated it. And so she and her, and they couldn't even send letters home because the school would censor it because they knew all the children wanted to go home. So she snuck into the town and sent a letter home through the post, you know, the post office. And her mother came to pick her up and rescue her, and her best friend, her mother as well. And they said, well, you know, we're really tired. Let's spend a few days here. And they said, oh, no, we want to go home. And so they spent one night, and then they all went home, and that was August 5th. And, of course, the bomb was dropped the next day.
We're visiting with award-winning author and journalist Chris Wallace. Chris is the author of the book Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb. Chris, you, as I mentioned, you do go and take us through different characters. A lot of people have read or seen pictures of Colonel Tibbetts with his airplane, the Enola Gay. But a lot of people are not that familiar with the second bomb, the second plane, and the pilot of that plane. And this is something that almost didn't happen.
Well, everything went absolutely perfectly in the first mission. And they asked Tibbetts if he wanted to fly the second mission. And he said, no, once is enough. And you can imagine. So they had a second mission and almost an entirely new flight crew. And everything that went right on the first mission went wrong on the second mission, so much so that when they got back, I mean, they almost didn't take off because of weight issues, and they missed. They wanted to go to one target zone, and there was not a sufficient visibility there, so then they went to Nagasaki. I mean, that's how people lived or died, just by pure chance. And when they finally landed, the commander, where when Tibbetts landed, he was immediately given the Distinguished Flying Cross. When the crew of the second plane landed for the Nagasaki flight, they were told, we should be court-martialing you, but we're going to let it go.
So what happened to that pilot?
They were fine. I mean, they stayed on. They, you know, nothing happened. I think the feeling was that, you know, they dropped the bomb and it worked, so that was that.
One of the things that I was surprised a couple years ago when this other book came out, Indianapolis, the fact that this was the ship that was carrying the bomb, the elements, to the island. And this is a ship that, after it dropped off those parts, was involved in one of the worst naval history disasters in naval history.
Yeah, it's right. The USS Indianapolis left the coast of California and went off to Tinian Island, which was where the flight crew of the Enola Gay was going to take the flight. You know, was that was the launch pad for the flight to Hiroshima. And when they got there, they dropped off the uranium. And then they left and went on for the rest of their mission, and they were immediately sunk. It was the last destroyer to be sunk during the war.
We've been visiting with award-winning author and journalist Chris Wallace. Chris is the author of the book Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. Chris, thank you so much for being with us, and where can people go to find out about your book?
Well, thank you very much, and you obviously read the book in detail. You can buy it at your local bookstore. You can obviously go online and get it. And I know today is Father's Day, but it's a good late Father's Day present, Countdown 1945.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Louis.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.